I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are back with another of our Sunday Brain Trust live streams coming at you on DLive and Entropy. Countercurrents Radio is brought to you, by our listeners. And if you would like to donate to Countercurrents, you can do that through entropystream.live/countercurrents. It's across the bottom of the screen. And that will take you to Entropy. Entropy is a platform, a very rare and special platform. It's the only platform on the internet that will allow people to use credit cards to send money to Countercurrents. So it's a very important place. And if you would like to leave a question, comment, and donation at Entropy, we'd be most grateful. We will read it in the course of this live stream and we will comment on it. And I would also like to draw your attention to the fact that there are now two weekly Countercurrents live streams. On Saturday, we have the new Writer's Block with Nicholas Gilvey, who's one of our valued authors. That streams live on DLive and Entropy from noon to 2 p.m. Eastern, our Pacific time. And of course, you can do the math. It starts at 3 o'clock on the East Coast, and I guess at 9 o'clock in Central Europe, where Nick is. So anyway, that is something that you should definitely check out. That is going to be featuring a lot of Countercurrents writers as well. Today, we are going to have a stream with Mark Gullick and Stephen Paul Foster. Stephen hasn't joined us yet. I'm sure he'll join us soon. But I would like to bring Mark on. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me. And I think, in a rather sinister way, you've just unmuted me. I thought I was the only person that could do that. But you.
Yeah, I have the power of muting you.
That's good. It's very good for me. As I say, thank you very much for inviting me on. It's nice to. It's a pleasure to write for your site, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, across the bottom of the screen, as a ticker tape kind of scrolling banner, is the link for all of the writings at Countercurrents by Mark Gullick and also Stephen Foster.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and Mark is the author of a novel, Vanakin in the Underworld, which has been reviewed twice at Countercurrents, once by James O'Meara and once by Stephen Paul Foster. He's also the author of Bestest Boys and Cherub Valley and many essays and reviews that you can read at Countercurrents. And I was pleased to learn that, like me, he belongs to a very special club, the club of people who have PhDs in philosophy. And I thought, you know, we have so many interesting writers at Countercurrents. I discovered this on our birthday live stream back in June. About your PhD and also Stephen's PhD. And I thought we need to just get together and have a philosopher's round table, a kind of symposium, and let our readers and listeners ask some really deep questions. So that's what the plan is today. We're going to do some deep questions today. And so let me just thank a few people who have sent donations since the last week. Nils has written in with $55. Thank you very much. He says, I nearly forgot, so I threw in an extra five. Anyway, here's the donation for September, given, as always, in the name of the great God, Yngwie Freyr. Hugo writes in with $58. Thank you. C writes in with three. Sunshine Kid writes in with $10 and a question about Vico, which we will get to. Bartleby writes in with $10 and thanks Catherine for being a guest on our last episode, yesterday's episode of the Writer's Block. Branson writes in with $40. Thank you very much. Gadius writes in with 30. And I would like to actually begin with the question that Gadius asked. And that is the following. Let me just read the whole thing. I believe moral concerns are the chief impediment to getting decent regular folks thinking along these lines. What do you gentlemen think would be the most effective and concise moral argument you could use to make people receptive to our cause? Let's say ethnic nationalism, populism, national self-determination, and so forth. Mark, I sent this to you earlier, so you had a chance to think about it. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
Before I even start on that, I liked the fact that you mentioned that, you know, There are several people who write for Countercurrency who are extremely well qualified, PhDs and so on. When you Google Countercurrents, you get the first hit I get is the Southern Poverty Law Center, who describe you as a site which is academic white nationalism. And academic is put in quotes, scare quotes.
Right.
I keep meaning to write to them and say, I think we're probably more academic than you are, actually. I'd like you to line up your PhDs and compare it to ours. But that's kind of neither here nor there. go back again, because I remember reading this one earlier on. Could you just read that one back to me again, the last bit?
Yeah, I'll read it again. I believe moral concerns are the chief impediment to getting decent, regular folks thinking along our lines. What do you gentlemen think would be the best or the most effective and concise moral argument you could use to make them receptive to our cause?
Okay, and I have thought about this for other reasons. And I don't have children, I'm full declaration, but I think teach your children right. Morality is not a mathematical structure that you can build and give to people and plug it in like software. I remember once I was commended on my manners by somebody, and she said, your parents must have taught you, you know, good manners. And I thought about that, and I thought, no, they didn't. They just displayed good manners, and I copied them. And there's a lot of this idea of mimicking, the same sort of thing that happens in the animal kingdom. You know, certain types of wasps imitate other bees or whatever, so they can hide out in their hive and just basically get the honey without doing the work, that sort of thing. Morality is very, very interesting because it can be subverted. And you see politicians doing this all the time. Now, you're seeing it in the States, and we're certainly seeing it in, well, say, we. I haven't been back to the UK for 5 years or 5.5 years. But morality is... The worrying thing about morality is who gets to say what is right and what is wrong. The arbiter paradox, I'd call it. I just do believe that it starts with education, it starts with kids. And of course, well, not of course, but it seems to me that one of the worst and most deleterious things that's happened in the last 10, 20 years, as I would say, is that the malevolent left have got hold of education. So instead of going and doing your times tables and your alphabet and your, you know, when you're 3 and 4 and whatever it is, you're now being taught, it's okay to be transgender, you know, that's good. And anyone says it isn't good is a bad person. Someone has got hold of the helm of the good ship morality. Very dangerous times, I think, for a child. I would rather be 60 than 6, let's put it that way.
Right. Stephen is here, so let me add him to the stream and we will continue discussing this. One second.
Great.
To go
back to morality, what you were saying, and as you know, I'm a Nietzsche, and you can tell that from my writing, I think. And everyone assumes, well, the big book about, you know, is the genealogy of morals. I find that stodgy, and I've never been a big fan. Chapter 5 of Beyond Good and Evil, when he talks about morality, and he says something like, morality is a very late arrival on the European scene. And therefore, the moral scientists, he calls them, I don't know what the original German is, he says the moral scientists are, you know, in the same way, concomitantly, they're sort of fumbling around trying to, and he quotes Schopenhauer, as he often does, in a kind of negative way, because he loved Schopenhauer, but he didn't really, he never quotes him in a positive way, it's strange. But morality is something I believe comes from a community first. It's not graven in stone. I've always been suspicious of that whole Moses coming down with the tablets idea. You know, this is the 10 things that, you know, you do and don't do. They will kind of turn up anyway in most primitive or even modern societies, if those societies are allowed to grow organically and not monkeyed with, not interfered with in a sort of communistic or Stalin, you know, the engineer of human souls type of thing, where we will tell you what is right. You don't decide yourself. That's the big leap for me. Once states say, hey, before you speak, just read our little table of 10 commandments, and then be very careful, because if you say there are only two genders, the police will be around in a minute.
Right. Well, but I guess, well, first of all, I think Stephen is ready, so I'm going to add him to the stream and we'll do the
great
intro.
Good.
Okay. Stephen, are you there?
Yeah. Okay. Great. Yeah. I saw those technical problems, so I think
hello,
I got
Stephen.
the dog out of the room.
The technical problem sounded like a hound to me.
Well, a bit of that, yeah.
Folks, Stephen Foster is one of our resident PhDs. He's part of our little think tank at Countercurrents. He's the author of a couple of academic books in philosophy. He's also the author of a couple of novels, Toward the Bad I Kept on Turning, which we've had reviewed at Countercurrents by James O'Meara, and also After Harry Met Sally, a novel of philosophical discovery. So we had this question from Gadius, who's one of our stalwarts. He's always in the chat. He's moderating. He's donating. He's sending links out. He's a great, great asset. So he goes first. There's virtue gets rewarded here. And his question is, I believe moral concerns are the chief impediment to getting decent, regular folks thinking along our lines. What do you gentlemen think would be the most effective and concise moral argument you could use to make people receptive to ethnic nationalism? Let's call it that. And Mark was talking about part of the problem that we face is that, of course, our enemies control education, and they are broadcasting lots of moral messages that basically stigmatize any ethnic nationalism, any desire for people to remain who they are and not be mixed in a multicultural melting pot and things like that. So Gadius really wants to know, though, are there arguments that we can give them for why it's not a bad thing? Why Mette Frederiksen, who is the leader of the Social Democrats in Denmark, said something wonderful a couple of years ago when the Social Democrats came out against immigration and started talking about repatriation of immigrants. And she said, being opposed to immigration doesn't make you a bad person. And I guess what we really need to do is break through and get people to accept that nationalism doesn't make you a bad person. So are there arguments for why nationalism doesn't make us bad people? So Stephen, you've just been added to the stream. Do you have some thoughts on this? And then we'll go back to Mark, and I'll toss some of my thoughts in as well.
Right. Well, yes, I do. I saw the question ahead of time and have given it some thought. And I think the first thing I think you have to determine with this question is you have to limit your audience to those who you think are even open to an argument. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges, is because our opponents start with premises that are simply unacceptable to begin an argument with them. So I think the first thing you have to do is look for a potential audience that at least you can appeal to on some grounds, on a moral ground, on some other grounds. And I think, first of all, for that type of an audience, and I'm thinking here of friends, family members who find the idea of ethnic nationalism, of white advocacy, they recoil away from it in large part because of the propagandistic nature of the mainstream media. But I think the way to begin is to appeal not so much, is to use not so much a moral argument as an argument from self-interest. And what I typically do with people that I can have a conversation with, who are at least open to talking about these things is I appeal to their sense of self-interest, not personally, not them exactly, but what about your children? What about your grandchildren? Your children are white. Do you think in 20 years that your grandson or your granddaughter, when they're an adult, do you think that racism is going to go away and that they will be forgiven? I mean, I think most reasonable people, when you talk to, when you present that case, recognize that no, that's not. We're up against something, and so you have to first of all, I think, come in with a self-interest. And then, of course, we have historical examples. You can point to South Africa. You can point to Zimbabwe. You can point to places in the world where whites have been generous, whites have been forgiving, whites have extended themselves. And then you look and see what happens. I found that I'm actually able to convince some people at least to take another look at my position.
So do you think that self-interest is not the same as a moral argument?
Well, there's an aspect of morality of morality and self-interest. I mean, I think that's one of the things you have to point out in these conversations is that the woke white folks are really embracing a kind of ethno suicide. If you consider suicide to be immoral, then yes, of course, it's a deeply moral argument.
Yeah, I would agree with that. In my book, White Identity Politics, I have an essay called White Identity Politics, Inevitable, Necessary, and Moral. And in there, I talk about why we have to make a moral argument, because even though you can argue that white identity politics is inevitable, it's inevitable because when people get pushed around ethnically by other groups in competition, political competition, eventually they'll tire of that and push back. I argue it's necessary because without it, you lose in a multicultural society where other groups play the race card or the identity politics card. And if you don't do that, it's akin to basically taking a knife to a gunfight. It's just a losing strategy. But there are a lot of people who are willing to lose if they think it's the right thing to do. People are willing to suffer a great deal. They're willing to basically defy necessity. They're willing to defy inevitability if they think that's the moral thing to do. So we've got to overcome these moral hang-ups that they've got about identity politics. And the first argument that I make is that there's nothing wrong with giving preference to your own before other people. Charity begins at home. It's just natural and normal for you to have feelings of solidarity with your family, over strangers, with your community, over people further away, with your nation as opposed to other nations, and with your race as opposed to other races. And I think that's a reasonable position to take. You can defend that morally, and I think that cuts one of the groundings out of a lot of this sort of reckless altruism that you get in discussions of immigration and so forth. We have to let these people in. Let them all in. You hear that kind of thing. It would be wrong. It would be stingy to have borders, to have standards and things like that, to keep people out, to keep people distant. And it's really not wrong at all if it's okay for you to prefer your own first.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think those are definitely good arguments. I think unfortunately they don't seem to be taking hold. The argument is good is only as long as you can force the conclusion from your interlocutor, and they don't seem to be willing to take that step. I find it very frustrating.
Yeah, well, I mean, there. I guess we have to make a distinction, and we'll bring Mark back in too. But we have to make a distinction between people who are persuadable and people who aren't.
Right.
There are people who are not persuadable, and often those are the people you're arguing with in public. These people are just not open to revising their views at all. However, if there's an audience, there might be people in the audience with open minds. And so oftentimes what you end up doing is you argue with closed-minded, bullet-headed, angry people, hoping that some of the lurkers and bystanders will, you know, get their minds opened by that. And I think that those are the people we have to worry about. And we might never be able to get really convinced ideological opponents to change their views. It's just very, very hard to do. I've done it with some people. I knew an honest liberal in Atlanta, actually a couple of them. I worked on them for years. They're still friends with me too. But there are a lot of people who just, they hold their views for non-rational reasons, and therefore it's almost impossible to talk them out of them with rational means. But if there are people who are in the audience who are capable of that, those are the people that you can go for. And they might not even admit that you're persuasive. And sometimes it takes years. I know I'm still catching up to classes that I took in graduate school or even things that teachers said when I was an undergraduate. Suddenly it'll hit me. It's like, I've finally grown into this. It finally makes sense. So I don't know if it's necessary for us to think that our success hinges on getting our opponents to admit that they're wrong or to change their conclusions or change their premises.
Yeah, that's true. I think there's so much... there's so much to deter even a person who may be convinced. There's so much social punishment that's handed out for people who depart from the standard narrative. So there's a Leonard Shapiro, who was historian of Soviet Union, wrote up what I thought was a great definition of propaganda. And he said, it's a uniformed pattern of utterance, the departure from which pushes a person out in glaring consideration. So the standard narrative, racism and all of that is, it comes with a patois that everyone speaks, or everyone around me speaks, almost everyone. And so when you depart from it, you really stand out and people look at you suspiciously. And for people in positions of in teaching positions, particularly at a university, where that narrative is really enforced and it's punished when you depart from it. It really inhibits a lot of people who might be convinced, who would like to say something, but they fear for their jobs, they fear for their positions, they fear for their status or their reputations.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that I got out of academia. There was a great joke that Hans-Georg Gadamer told. He said, on the eighth day after resting, God noticed that there was one thing he could do to perfect creation. He had left something out. So to perfect creation, he created the German professor. And then the devil came along and ruined it by creating the colleague. And I always thought that was beautiful, because there was being a professor seemed like paradise to me, but the colleagues were really the snakes in the garden. And so once I got out of academia, I could do the philosophical things that I wanted to without the colleagues and the committees and the endless meetings and stuff like that, and the pressures to conform. It was good to get away from all that. Mark, do you want to come back in? Are you there? Do you want to unmute?
I've just unmuted. I think I'm back. Yeah,
you're back.
I love the fact you mentioned Gadamer, because apparently his essays his lectures were extraordinarily good. But the students, there would be like a sort of 3 or 4 minute section where he really would ramble and just go into, and students got bored and they counted their boredom with a thing called the GAD. So how many GADs was that lecture today? Oh, about 6, I reckon. Oh, I thought 7 actually.
Oh, that's interesting. I had no idea that he was a unit of boredom. That's fascinating.
The GAD. Stephen mentioned something earlier on about essentially it's white countries that are taking the beating. Look at Australia now. I mean, it's my goodness, you just need to look at YouTube and they're beating people up for drinking alcohol. They're whacking people in the street. The thing about morality is that there is no, and we talked about this earlier on before Stephen was around, Greg, the fact that there isn't what I call the arbiter paradox. Who says what's right? And who says that they were able to say that was right? And who said they? It's an infinite regress. My friend in Paris, lovely guy, journalist, he took me to see an old market, which has been kind of, kept in its original form. And there's a meter on the wall for the linen sellers to measure out a meter. So they would go like, oh, yep. They'd spread it out and go, that's a meter. Well, that doesn't exist for morality. There's no meter rule on the wall in Paris or anywhere to say what's right and what's wrong. Why are we better than the Taliban because we don't cut people's heads off for rape? Why? It's a knotty problem, and it's not one I think probably that should there are conservatives who I know in Britain who think, you know what, Taliban have got it right. Steal something, get a whipping. Now, even the extreme right of the Republican Party, if such a thing exists, would sort of flinch at that, as it were. So who says what is moral? And to go on and again to reconnect with what Stephen said earlier on about the white countries are success victims. I say we success victims of their own success. We set it up and we allowed the people to go, well, you didn't set it up enough in our favor. Now we want more, always more. Where does India think it would be without the British Empire? What kind of country would it be? Hindu India, I suspect, would be doing pretty well. Muslim India would be, excuse my language, but screwed. Pakistan, Bangladesh, they would be double screwed. Your moral program, I still believe this, your moral program comes from the community in which you grew up. And if it's a good one, good luck to you. If it's a bad one, here we go. Grew up in Chicago? Problems. Grew up in Surrey in England? Okay. What is the normative, in other words? Where are we going from with morals? What's right and what's wrong? We all know what not to do and what to do, but who else knows what? There was a case the other day, and an Afghani, I think he was Afghani, might have been Somali, I'm not sure, in Germany, raped a young girl, and he said, well, his obviously not him, his defence lawyer said, he didn't understand that it's not right to do that. And you think, right, you didn't. So we're importing people from a place that thinks a 15-year-old girl is just game. Now, you've got real problems if you mix two. When we were kids, we were in the chemistry class, and there were 6 test tubes in front of us with clear liquids in them. And the chemistry teacher said, okay, I'm just going to go and get my book and set the class up. The only thing I want to tell you guys is don't mix the two chemicals from on the end test tubes. because it'll blow up, it'll explode. And of course, me and one other kid, who later became a great friend of mine, that's the first thing we did. Of course, nothing happened. It just changed colour so that when he came out, he knew who the bad guys in the class were. He knew who the ones who were going to cause trouble were. So he sat us separately and boom, 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 boom. How can you do that with the world? You know, is your morality the same as a Japanese man or a Icelandic man? Or I don't know. Or, you know, incest is illegal everywhere because we know that it's not a good thing. But I've met people and worked for people who are Muslim and they've got mentally handicapped children because of the effects of first cousin marriages, which we all know about. I mean, it's an extraordinary unspoken of scandal in Britain, and I assume everywhere. You know, these people are, and when I say mentally handicapped, I don't mean Down syndrome. I mean completely unable to dress themselves. So our morality doesn't seem to work for some people, and their morality doesn't seem for us. Where is the meter rule in Paris?
Well, I do think that if you take basically a relativist position about morals, that they are culturally relative, then you can construct an argument against multiculturalism based on the fact that if you've got radically different moral codes, they can't really coexist in the same space. You simply will have conflict over them, which is, I think that's a valid argument.
And so they should stay separate.
Yeah, so they should stay separate.
They should stay separate.
You get the argument for, and it's very interesting how leftists and liberals will be cultural relativists at breakfast, and then by lunchtime, they've metamorphosed into absolutists and imperialists and moralists who want to send people out with guns to stick needles in your arm, or send bombers back to Afghanistan to force these savages to do the right thing with women. The imperialist position, basically, I mean, one of the things that you can say about moral absolutists is that they often are used to justify imperialism and meddling in other people's affairs, or mixing peoples together because, well, frankly, some people just, they have to leave. It's very interesting. They're multiculturalists until it's time to talk about women's rights. And then they become absolutists. But then
I notice this in Britain a lot, that the journalists who go, oh, you're a racist if you don't like multiculturalism, you look them up and you go to their websites and their Twitter feeds and all this stuff. I mean, I don't do all that myself anymore, but you know, you go there and you find, oh, look, she lives in Hampstead in London. Like the whitest area you could possibly live in, I think, in England. So of course she's going to go, like, because she doesn't live in Southall. She doesn't live in Brixton. She doesn't know what it's like to live around Muslims or blacks. I mean, I hate to be so blunt about it, but the media is all very, very virtue signaling because they don't have to go through it all.
Right, it's just abstract. When you don't actually have to share.
It's a nice thing to say for them. It's gonna fill another, you know, couple of columns. They get their money, bang, bang, bang. But they don't have to walk back from the, you know, like my ex girlfriend in England has to walk back with a friend from her tube station. She has to call her because she's in a kind of quite a black area, and she's a blondie, and you know, it's just not worth the risk.
Absolutely.
Well, why should an English person have to call a friend to take them back to the taxi stand?
After the migrant crisis and the huge number of sexual assaults that took place in Cologne around
2015 was the big one, wasn't it? New Year's Eve.
The left wing female mayor of Cologne said that, I think this was for Fashing, you know, a few months later, that they were going to create a safe zones for women.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, well, my response to that, I wish these things would have gone viral. I never got the hang of getting them to go viral. Why can't all of Germany be a safe zone for women?
Yes.
You know, the reason why all of Germany can't be safe.
The way that Islam works in Europe is actually quite calculated. It's not just, you know, a dumb influx of, it's not, you know, some kind of invading bunch of chimps or something. What they do is they find a place, then they'll colonize it, then they'll take over the central spaces, the public spaces. And that's very interesting because that, and Stephen and you will know all about this. The public spaces, for me, is where philosophy started, with the Agora, with Plato. You know, think of all the Platonic dialogues. Where did they start? In the square. It wasn't a lecture theatre or it wasn't a university there or anything like that. It would be like, oh, Crates, I see you're going to the court. Where are you going there? Oh, my father is on trial today. Oh, is he guilty, do you think? Well, I'm not sure, Socrates. Let's talk about it. Bang, the public square. It's wonderful. Now, in Bonn, in Bruges, in Amsterdam, those public spaces with the fountains and the lovely things we all know. I mean, if they ever get a hold of Florence, God help us all. But literally, they're starting to be invaded by, and it is an invasion. They're invaded by Muslim, Arabists. Who suddenly take the place over. Then the white people move out. Then the next thing you know, in a year's time, there'll be somebody on the council, and before you know it, Sharia law is in. Bang, job done.
Yeah, there's a very, listening to you, Mark and Greg, talk in the remarks on Germany and what's going on in Germany and the rest of Western Europe, it's a very interesting parallelism with the U.S. In Germany, this is the German people. The German people are still living with denazification and the mm-hmm. great terror, horror,
and always will.
Any actual real German is that somebody will call them a Nazi. So the denazification program that was officially conducted for 5 years, I mean, the Allies were there from 45 to 50 before they finally turned it over to, felt safe enough okay. to turn it over to the denazified Germans. Well, mm-hmm. now we've got Angela Merkel, who's still continuing the denazification. And to atone for what the terrible things the Germans did, they decided to open up the floodgates and let in the Third World. Well, the parallel with the U.S., what we see here, Greg, you and I here in the U.S., is our burden is slavery and segregation.
No, right.
We're still being punished for that.
That's your Holocaust. Yeah.
And so it's our Holocaust. And so what we have to do here is we have to open our floodgates, and then we have to have white people constantly apologizing.
And, you know, even countries that never had slavery in the Holocaust or colonies, they're targeted for it too. And the argument just changes. It's like, oh no, you simply have to open your gates because you've got mm-hmm. more stuff than they do.
Mm-hmm. And also Stephen and Greg, when's enough? Because yes. as you know, it's never enough for the left. You gave us that, then we want one more.
Yeah, one thing that I like to do with these arguments when I'm just having just sort of tiptoeing into a topic about diversity is just to ask people, is there ever too much diversity? Can there ever be too much of it?
What about the NFL and the NBA, the National Football?
Yeah.
Is that diverse enough?
Yeah. Well,
why are there no Chinese guys in the NBA? By the way, that was amazed me.
Well, anyway, we've been going at this for more than 30 minutes, so let's shift because we have other questions here.
Good,
I think
good.
It's a perennial topic. My answer to this question is basically in my essay, "White Identity Politics: Necessary, Inevitable, Necessary, and Moral," where I talk about consequentialist arguments, arguments from fairness, arguments from self-actualization, and the idea of love of one's own. And there's another essay I have on the website called Three Pillars of White Identity Politics, Kinship, Culture, and Love of One's Own, where I expand mm-hmm. upon this discussion of Love of One's Own. And I think that's foundational. It's perfectly natural, normal, and right to have a preference for your own over strangers. And if we can establish that in people's minds, I think we're a long way towards diffusing a lot of these fake moral absolutes. The main fake moral absolute that's lobbed at us all the time in politics is that identity politics is perfectly moral and good for all groups except white people. And it's even more fine-grained than that. Identity politics is even fine with white people as long as they're minorities and not the founding population of the country they live in. So Swedish identity politics in Sweden is absolute Nazism. It's the worst thing in the world. But if you're a Swede living in Finland, then Swedish identity politics is a great thing. So basically what this does is that it weaponizes identity politics against the founding population of any European country and only European countries. The Japanese aren't burdened with this nonsense, at least not yet. Let's hope they never are. Alex writes in with a question. What books had the greatest influence on you as a college student? And how have you evolved since then? Well, I'm going to go first on that, just because I have a very brief answer on that. I mean, there's a long list of books that I would like to revisit or that are foundational for me. But the book that had the most influence is Plato's Republic. And I think that I haven't evolved beyond it. That's the thing about the Republic that's so amazing to me. Plato's analysis of the human soul, his analysis of the virtues, and his analysis of different political regimes and how they rise and fall and mutate one into another, I still find that valuable. I still find that useful to this day. I haven't evolved beyond it. Stephen, you go next. What books had the greatest influence on you as a college student, and how have you evolved since then?
Well, like you, Greg, Plato's Republic was enormous. I read that as a freshman, and then as a graduate teaching assistant, I taught the Republic many times through many semesters, and each time I taught it, I discovered something in it I didn't realize before. So it had a tremendous impact on with the first reading. And then as I go back to it, the wisdom that's in it. The other major work was, of course, it's Nicomachean Politics.
Whoops, I'm losing some.
Yeah, I'm losing you. You're back.
Me and Greg were both losing you, so there's obviously some glitch in that. Yeah, great. No, you're all right again now. Yeah.
Okay. So Plato's Republic and then Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics and Politics were both huge as a college student, and as I go back and read them, I find things. I find the wisdom is enhanced for me. They're perennial for me. The one other book I wanted to mention that I read as a college sophomore that was huge with me was not a philosophy text, but it was a history book. It was A.J.P. Taylor's Origin of the Second World War.
Oh, fantastic.
It's an incredible book, and I can't imagine how he got away with writing that. I mean,
Taylor was an absolute genius.
If he wrote it today, no one would publish it. I mean, it's an incredible book.
He wouldn't get near a publisher. He'd probably go to jail if he tried that now.
Yeah. He probably would. And the thing I find so amazing about it, as I look back decades back at it, is he's been totally vindicated. His insight into the origins of the Second World War are absolutely fantastic. And the current book that was a book that was just recently reviewed, Greg, on Countercurrent, Stalin's War, really confirms what A.J.P. Taylor was writing about 50 years ago.
Yeah, I agree. That is a fantastic book, and very elegantly argued, very totally convincing, frankly. Ron Unz did a big piece at the Unz Review about just revisionist histories that he read. And of course, when he read Taylor, when he was an undergraduate at Harvard, he wasn't a revisionist historian. He was a mainstream historian. Right. And what's happened is a huge amount of mainstream history has been simply swept into the dustbin and marginalized since the Second World War, especially. And it's quite remarkable how important a lot of these figures were in the teens, 20s, 30s, up into the 40s and 50s, and then they just became completely marginalized unpeople. I can't remember the name of the essay, but it's a really fantastic compendium about basically historians who have been unpersoned because of the war narrative.
One of the other ones that he mentions was Charles Beard.
These
were a lot of these historians. They were mainstream, as you say, Greg. They were mainstream historians. They were publishing. They were publishing in the major journals. That Charles Beard, for a time, was president of the American Historical Association. And Beard was very, very critical. Did very, very critical of FDR's conduct of the Second World War. He was very suspicious about the entry of America into the Second World War, the smearing of the isolationists. And he was basically non-personed out of the profession.
Yeah. So, Mark, what are some of the books that had the greatest influence on you as a college student, and how have you evolved
I've got a reasonable timeline for my reading. I like all boys of my generation, I'm 60, as I said. I read science fiction till I was about 16. Just like constant Vonnegut and Dick and Asimov. I saw Asimov lecture, actually. He was amazing. I asked him a specific question. I said, "Doctor," and he'd taken ages to get over there because he was scared of flying. He would never fly. And he came over by boat, took him about 2 weeks. Anyway, I went to see him at this London university. My mum got me tickets for my birthday, bless her. This is a nice thing to do. Anyway, I said, Dr. Asimov. Do you think that it's the role of the science fiction writer to prepare us for the future? And he gave a great long answer, and it was all good, and so on and so forth. Science fiction. And then when I was about 16, someone gave me a copy of Virginia Woolf's Orlando, and I read that and thought, oh, I didn't realize prose could be that free. And I mean, I'm not a great fan of Woolf now, but I was then. No, it's like Lord of the Rings. Read it at 15. Don't read it when you're 55. Just do it when you should do it. The first philosophy books were definitely Beyond Good and Evil and Descartes' Discourse on the Method. I'd never read anything so clear. And I know that Descartes wrote in Latin. I believe I'm right in saying that. They pretty much did at that time. I don't think he wrote Discourse in French. I may be wrong, but I think he wrote in Latin. But once I read Descartes, I thought, now I'm thinking down a much straighter path than I was thinking before. Before it was all a bit jumbled and, well, what's the world? What's the world? I don't really know. And you suddenly get hold of Descartes and you go, so you can doubt everything? Oh, everything's like a dream. And then, right. And then probably the next one I bumped into that 2 years later was Being in Time. And as somebody said about Hegel, I can't remember who it was, a Hegel scholar said, I wandered into Hegel about 20 years ago and I haven't wandered out yet. I'm still not outside of Being in Time. But
that's interesting.
That really did bounce me around. I didn't know that you could operate in a philosophical way which was so close to personal experience. So Sartre tried to do it. He tried to replicate it with Being in Nothingness, but it was like a tribute band, you know. It really was. I thought Being in Nothingness was fun in parts, but you know, it was just like a Kiss tribute band or something. It wasn't worth it. So, yeah, those books, I think.
The problem with being in nothingness is it's about 600 or 700 pages long and tiny. Mm-hmm. And I'll be brutally honest, I got 55 to 60 pages into it and gave up. I just
Derrida mentions it actually in a nice essay, which I can't remember. And he talks of, it might be The Truth in Painting. Yes, I think it is. I know Derrida's not a particularly popular chap on Countercurrents, but I have a lot of time for the fella. I think he's a little bit too much maligned, I think. He talks about Cézanne painting a picture of a scene in Proust, and it's a table set for the upper class to come and have their dinner, and there's linen, and there's, you know, all the wine bottles, the crystal glass, and all that sort of thing. And it says something like the linen tablecloth laid over the table like freshly fallen snow on the mountain or something like that. And Cézanne, in one of his letters, I don't know who to, could have been to Van Gogh, I don't know, but he said, when I paint, I can't paint the snow. I just have to paint what's there. If I painted the snow, I'm lying. I'm lying. That, push metaphor out the way and get in there. And Sartre mentions that. And also the thing about bad faith, I thought that was pretty neat. You know, the whole night of bad faith and all the cafe waiter and all that stuff in Being and Nothingness. But no, apart from that, I mean, apart from anything else, Sartre said, oh, there's no such thing as a right-wing intellectual.
Yeah, but that's
you defended Stalin, mate. That's why Camus stopped being your mate,
right? So this is a question from LC, Lovecraft's cat. It's a very simple question: Schopenhauer or Nietzsche? Basically, the question is: who's the greater philosopher, Schopenhauer or Nietzsche? So, Stephen, do you want to go first?
I'm happy to go first. Those are two philosophers that haven't paid huge attention to, but I guess I would go with Nietzsche as the greater philosopher, and the reason for it would be, in my opinion, simply I think the impact he's had on contemporary thinkers such as Heidegger. So I guess my response would be Nietzsche.
What about you, Mark? You're sort of a Nietzschean.
It sounds like it's one of those soccer penalty shootouts here. But yeah. When Nietzsche was a very young man, he was in, I think it was Leipzig in Germany, and he walked into a secondhand bookshop just by chance, and he picked up the world as Will as an idea, or sometimes translated the world as will and representation. But he said something called me to the book. No. And anyway, he took it home and he said he was fascinated by it. You know, he just the whole book, the whole feel of the book, a bit like what Heidegger said about Husserl's book. He said even the whole shape of the book was kind of fascinating to me, and the front page and all that sort of stuff. It's amazing that Nietzsche was so influenced by Schopenhauer, and yet just can do nothing but criticize him. I mean, if you see that, if you look at the essay Schopenhauer as Educator in the, is it in the Untimely Meditations?
Yeah.
He's not really a cheerleader for Schopenhauer. He just says, but much as Kant, and I understand that you know a good deal about Kant. Much as Kant said about Hume, you know, he woke me up. He got me asking questions. I don't like these penalty shootouts. Who's the better philosopher? I love them both. I love the world as will and idea. I think Schopenhauer's writing on music is the best I've ever read.
Oh, absolutely.
I'd say it was a one-all draw. It's a tie. It's a tie.
Okay, Stephen is back.
Yeah, I'm sorry. More technical problem.
Okay, no
problem.
Probably
had to feed the dog. Probably had to feed the dog, I should think.
Yeah. Okay. So, Schopenhauer or Nietzsche? I think that's a great question.
Schopenhauer, Stephen. Schopenhauer had a dog. Did you know that?
Yes.
That's right. I guess he did, didn't he?
The name of the dog was Atman, which apparently is a sort of Buddhist word for the world soul or something like that. But he was very fond of his dog.
Well, I guess he had that in common then with Rousseau, because Rousseau had a dog called Sultan.
That's interesting.
Famous dogs of history. We need to get together on that. Famous philosophy dogs of history.
Yeah, I know that Schopenhauer liked poodles, and
was a poodle. His dog was a poodle. Yes.
Yeah, I can't square the pessimist with owning a poodle for some sense. For some reason,
that doesn't.
But yeah.
Well, Nietzsche says in Beyond Good and Evil, "Can you believe this man is a pessimist?" He's talking about Schopenhauer. He says, "Can you believe this man is a pessimist? When every time he finished his evening meal, he played the flute."
Right.
And then he puts in brackets, "Check his biographers on this."
Well,
how can a man who plays the flute be a pessimist?
Yeah, my feeling is that in terms of like an overall worldview, I think that Schopenhauer has a more coherent overall worldview than Nietzsche. I also think that although Nietzsche is one of the great writers in philosophy, period, I think Schopenhauer is an even better stylist than Nietzsche.
Well, that's very interesting, because yeah. I'd spoken to Germans in the past, and I have no German at all. I speak some French, and obviously I live in Central America, so I speak Spanish. But I've never read Nietzsche in the original. But I've been told that his German is incredibly stylish and neat and beautiful and poetical. Of course, it won't you know translate into English that well. But Schopenhauer, I don't know. I've never talked to anyone about that. But style is very important to me. Style is a kind of delivery system for philosophy. You know, in the same way that an injection is a delivery system for a vaccination or something, whatever, to use the contemporary classic thing. But no, apparently Nietzsche is an excellent writer in German.
I think Schopenhauer is an even clearer writer. And the difference between the two of them is that both of them have beautiful metaphors and analogies. Mm-hmm. They have mm-hmm. lovely ways with words. Mm-hmm. But I find that Schopenhauer is also capable of creating extremely long, complex, systematic arguments.
Mm-hmm.
And you never lose the thread. It's just amazing how clear it all is, how careful he is. Whereas I find that, you know, I can read Nietzsche in little bits, and the little mm-hmm. bits make sense, but the overall architectonic of his arguments is hard to follow.
He's not a system man. He even says somewhere, and I can't remember where it is. He says, "Don't read me in." You know, don't read the whole book in an afternoon. Read 10 pages. It's a bit like P.G. Woodhouse said, you know, with the Jeeves and Worcester stories. He said, don't read a book. Read 10 pages a day. Cheer yourself up.
Right. Yeah. So Schopenhauer, I think, is also, I find, even though he's a self-described pessimist, and he says that ethics is about overcoming the will to live and things like that, which sounds quite bleak and awful. It's actually enormously life-affirming when you understand it, because when Schopenhauer talks about the will to live, another way of understanding the will to live is the fear of death. And if you put it this way, overcoming overcoming the fear of death is the great thing that frees you to live life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I completely agree with that. If you can go through a transformation where you lose your fear of dying, that's enormously liberating. And Schopenhauer had all kinds of advice for enjoying life. Mm-hmm. So he made a distinction between pure ethics, which is about mm-hmm. basically mm-hmm. breaking the will to live or overcoming the fear of death, mm-hmm. And could be sound very bleak and ascetic, and then just the art of living well. Which is full of very useful bits of advice.
A terrific sense of humor as well.
Absolutely.
I think I'm right in saying that Schopenhauer got involved in a legal dispute at the place where he was living. And he pushed an old lady down the stairs, and I think he broke her arm or something like that. And for some reason, the court, well, not for some reason, because he did it. The court said, you've got to pay her a certain amount of money for the rest of the... I hope I'm right on this. I can't remember where I read this. Some biography of Schopenhauer, I guess. When she died and he didn't have to pay her any money, he said in Latin, anus obit, onus abit. The old lady dies, the pledge disappears. So you know what I mean? It's like anus obit, obit. It's just perfect, perfect Latin. So he just went, oh, you know, bugger you. I'm going to go back to my little poodle.
Yeah.
It's been many years since I've read Schopenhauer. And one, he wrote a number of essays, if I'm not.
Yes, he did. Yes.
And one of my favorites.
One on suicide, I think.
Well, one I particularly liked was on noise.
That is an absolutely brilliant essay. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that essay. And he complains about the carriage driver cracking the whip outside of his house. It was a wonderful piece of brilliant, witty piece of writing.
I think he was called what we would say in England, and I assume it's used in the States as well, a curmudgeon.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, the On Noise essay is one of the most brilliant essays, and it's filled with absolutely brilliant analogies, I think, too. So we have another just book question here. This is from Sutton, who's been commenting at Countercurrents since, I think, the very first year we went online. Sutton writes in, for a recommendation, what's the best introductory history of philosophy book?
Wow.
So, Stephen, do you have a suggestion there?
Well, yeah, I saw that question. I was thinking about that, and three different... The answer to that sort of depends on what you're looking for and your level of sophistication. If you're looking, if you're looking for a great historian of philosophy and you're willing to do a lot of reading, then Frederick Copleston has this multi-volume history of philosophy that I think is really good for someone who really needs an introduction to philosophy and who really wants to cover the whole spectrum of Western philosophy or whatever particular portion of it they're interested in, from the pre-Socratics on through the classical moderns. Now, a more entertaining, shorter history to read is Bertrand Russell's History of Western Philosophy.
Yeah, yes.
Which is a fun read, but it's not. Russell had many, many great virtues, but being a historian was not one of them. But the book is
on Heidegger in that book. One chapter on Nietzsche, which he hates. Carry on.
And then the third one that came to mind, and it's more limited in its scope, but is Leszek Kolakowski's Mainstream of Marxism. Which is basically a history of Marxist philosophy and Marxist ideology. So those three books are what came to mind for me.
Those are very good suggestions. I would certainly second the Copleston. If you want, it's in 9 volumes. It's an immense.
Yeah, it's huge, right? Yeah,
but it's incredibly clear, very fair-minded, very precise. I very much like Copleston. There are very few things he gets wrong, and if he doesn't understand something, he'll just say so. The stuff he says about Fichte, it's very candid. It's like, I don't know what's going on here. Let's move on. That kind of stuff. For a simple one-volume history of philosophy, and some people will roll their eyes at this, I honestly think Will Durant's The Story of Philosophy is a really wonderful book.
Right.
He was a brilliant writer. It's very clear. It's very entertaining. He covers all the main ideas of classical thinkers up to the main modern thinkers. I enjoyed it tremendously. And I would, you know, I'd like to pick it up and reread it again someday. Another historian of philosophy, or way into the history of philosophy that I think is good, are some of the interviews that Brian McGee did.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah. You mentioned Brian McGee.
I love Brian McGee. Yeah, he's written great books on Wagner, on Schopenhauer. He wrote a great philosophical autobiography, Confessions of a Philosopher, and he did these wonderful interviews with contemporary philosophers, analytic philosophers, historians of philosophy. Yeah. They're absolutely wonderful ways to get into some very complex thinkers. He's just very, very good at that. So, Mark, do you have some recommendations? History and philosophy books.
You just pipped me at the post there. I was gonna mention McGee. I was looking at his life the other day. I think he died in 2009 or something. Certainly this century, but he was quite old. And that was the last time in Britain that philosophy got a sniff of televisual time. The great philosophers, he would sit down with Quine and A.J. Ayer. And you know, people like that. And I think he even interviewed Popper, I'm not sure. But anyway, they'd sit down and it's so great. You went and they're smoking cigarettes. Or, you know, the philosopher's going, yeah, do you mind if I just smoke a cigarette? No, not at all. Excellent. It's just like the good old days, you know. And yeah, and that book came out as The Great Philosophers. And I would give that to anyone who's about 18 when they can read. To get a kid into it. And I still do believe in this thing of like getting children. I read an excellent book about 20 years ago called Sophie's World. I don't know if you've come across that. I think it was written by a Danish guy or a Swedish guy.
Yeah, a Danish guy.
Do you remember the book?
Yeah, I haven't read it.
That was pretty neat. That was like, it was kind of a little bit bolted on, you know, the whole stuff. It's something like a dad and his daughter and they're missing each other and he's writing her letters. It's episode, not sort of novel. And he says like, oh, you might want to try, you know, Epictetus or Democritus or Plato. Or da, da, da. And it is nice. I think you have to, you can't give kids. I don't have kids, as I've said. Greg, do you have children?
No, I don't.
Yes, I have. I have two grown-up daughters, yeah.
See, I think things would change very much for people with children because you want to, you know, you're little tiny puppets at the moment and, do you want to watch MTV, it's whatever it is nowadays, you know, do you want to watch rubbish culture all day or do you want to read a little book that might make you think? I was reading today, as I do every year, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, and I would recommend that everybody gives that to their child. I think that's one of the most wonderful books I've ever read. You know the book, I mean, the C.S. Lewis one, the start of the Narnia novels. No, we're going back to what I was saying.
I would want to mention one other, I think, really great historian of philosophy, and that's Etienne Gilson. For any serious anyone with a serious interest in medieval philosophy, Gilson was fantastic.
I think Diogenes Laertius is The Lives of the Philosophers is fantastic just for the pre-Socratics. It's so simple and it's so, and you can even read it in Latin if you've got a bit of Latin. It's not, you know, so purely written, and it gives you what happened, you know, the whole idea of what happened before Plato. A lot of people don't know what happened before Plato. They think, okay, Plato was the beginning of philosophy. No. Democritus, Anaximander, Anaximenes, Thales, all these guys. You know, that's a good one. I got the Russell one you mentioned, the History of Western Philosophy. I did find it stodgy, and I do find him a stodgy writer, although I'm a massive fan. The Problems of Philosophy, actually, the little kind of five essay booklet, The Problems of Philosophy by Russell, I think is excellent. If you know someone who's old enough, you'd have to give that to someone 17, 18 years old and above. But that really gives you the whole thing of why do we have to prove that a table exists, all that stuff, you know, that epistemology, stroke ontology stuff. I love that. I remember being at university with a girl who, we were in our introductory philosophy course, and she was frowning. She's a sweet little kid, and she was frowning, and she was obviously not arms crossed and all this kind of thing. And she said, why would I even need to prove that the table exists? And the teacher looked at me and thought, Yeah, now we've got to a real important point. The important thing is you don't have to do that. You have to work out why you can think that it's possible to ask that question. That's what philosophy is about. Of course, your bloody table is there, otherwise your cup would fall over. You know, it's an interesting... Some people just push themselves out of philosophy. Nope. Like you remember Dr. Johnson when he read Berkeley and said there is no such thing as the physical world. It is all an idea. And Dr. Johnson kicked a stone and apparently broke a toe in his foot and said to Boswell, "Thus I refute him."
Exactly. So we have a question here from... Oh, okay. Yeah, this is a question on entropy. It comes in with $10 from Sunshine Kid. It's a question about Vico. Do you believe that Vico was a genuine believing Catholic theist, or was he a crypto deist agnostic who hid his true views in fear of the Inquisition? Do you know of any subsequent works that build upon and expand his theory of history? Well, I gave a lecture on Vico at the London Forum years ago, and I think it was my first lecture there. It was in September of 2014. And it's on Countercurrents. It's in my book, From Plato to Postmodernism. So I do have some thoughts on this. Vico's analysis of history and humanity doesn't make any reference. Well, he makes reference to revelation. Okay, throughout. But his analysis is naturalistic. And he has a cyclical view of history. The cyclical view of history does not in any way imply that there would be only one cycle. Cycles can go again and again. So I honestly think that his underlying assumptions about man are not the same as you would have from a Catholic, specifically a Catholic or a Christian, because they have a very peculiar, specific linear view of history, right? That doesn't go through cycles and won't continue on. So that makes me think that Vico's deepest convictions were not Orthodox Christian. Now, he does deny that he is a materialist, an Epicurean. And he does defend the idea of providence. But you don't necessarily have to be a Christian or an Orthodox, you know, theist to defend some notions of providence. I mean, there are many, many pagan philosophers who defended ideas of providence as well. So my thought about Vico is that it's very unlikely that he overlooked the fact that his theory of history and man and culture is heretical by Catholic standards. It's very unlikely that a guy so clever would have overlooked that. And so, yes, I think that he probably had to dissimulate his views in public, to avoid being treated as a heretic. I think that's perfectly reasonable assumption. So anyway, Stephen, Mark, do you have any thoughts on Vico? He's not the most commonly read guy, but he's somebody who's influenced me.
Greg, over to Stephen. I know the name, but I've never read him, so it's not my area of expertise. So okay. I'll leave it to
you. Yeah, I'm gonna have to go with you, Greg. I'm the same as Mark. I know of him. I had some vague passing. Paid vague passing attention to him many, many years ago, but I can't help with that question.
Okay.
Greg, you did mention, and I think this is interesting. I've become not a fan. It's not the NBA, but I've started studying Luther recently much more than I ever did. That whole thesis on the door thing, you know, when the 99 theses and the 1517 thing, and like, okay, Catholic Church, you believe that you can buy your way into heaven, you can buy your way out of purgatory, but and he went, no, you can't. bang, bang, bang on the door. That really, I thought that was as big as the Enlightenment for me. That, you know, yes, no, I don't know if you're Catholics, you guys are all Protestants or what you are. I'm kind of don't know where I am, but
well, let's actually move on to this question by Horatio.
All right, yeah, sure.
Because
maybe for another time, yeah.
Yeah, but Horatio sends in $25 and asks us to comment on the removal of the Robert E. Lee statue from Richmond this past week. In my opinion, this is state-sanctioned anti-white vandalism. They destroyed a magnificent statue just to destroy it. Well, my response to this is that isn't it rich that people are so bent out of joint about the Taliban taking over in Afghanistan again, when all across America we're having our Buddhas of Bamiyan moments with the overthrow and vandalization of European monuments. And it's not just Confederate monuments, it's anything connected with Europeans on this continent. So that is basically, it's iconoclasm, it's a
what's so incredible about it is the cowardice of the ruling class, the people, the ruling class, the elites that are allowing this to happen, that are giving in some cases open encouragement. It's just absolutely outrageous. I can't believe that the people in charge really are really sympathetic with this. I think they just simply, it's just simply appeasing the howling mob. I can't believe that these people really believe this.
Yeah, they are. It's incredibly cowardly. Well, some of them support it, and then the conservatives, the people who you'd think be guardians of law and order and history and tradition, of course, they're just too cowardly to do anything about it. So you've got the left constantly pushing this forward. The worst are full of passion and intensity, and lack all conviction.
Just very quickly for the two of you, Stephen, I don't know if you know, I live in Costa Rica. I left Britain about five.
Oh, okay. No, I didn't know that.
Office. Yeah, I got out. I'm glad I did, frankly, because I'd probably be in jail now for what I write. Here, I'm protected by Article 29 of the Costa Rican Constitution. Any, even a non-resident can write. I can write there are only two genders, and no policeman will visit my home. If I wrote that where I grew up in Croydon in South London, I might be in trouble. That's how weird it's got now. I'm freer in Central America than I would be in South London. That's where it is. Now, I was in every 90 days, I have to leave the country. They say for 3 days, but that's just a grey area. I was in Nicaragua last weekend, and I was in Nicaragua for precisely 7 minutes while I just turn around and go back to Costa Rica. That's it, 90 days. They know they don't want to throw gringos out when they know we bring money there. It's all good for them. But I went to Guatemala a couple of visits ago, and I was walking through the central park of Guatemala City, and I can't remember what the name of it is. It's beautiful, and then it's got all the statues of the old Guatemalan writers and philosophers and playwrights, and there are many of them, and they're very proud of them. If somebody tried to take one of those down, they'd be beaten up, and the police would probably help beating them up. You know, the idea that you can take away a country, they're fiercely nationalistic here, and I love it. It's Independence Day in 3 days' time on Wednesday, and the whole place will be a swarm of Costa Rican flags, and there'll be national music. And you couldn't do that in England now. They call you a fascist. It's very strange. Well,
yeah, it's gotten so absolutely insane here that they're even removing inanimate objects, not even statues.
Yeah.
Or
yeah. Robert E. Lee has to go. He has to go.
Yeah, there was a large rock at the campus at the University of Wisconsin that had some association 80 years ago with some.
And apparently, it was racist. Why was that rock?
It's a racist. Well, it's a racist rock. I mean, racism now is sort of like it's the phlogiston theory. It's this mist that it
itself to people and to things, and somehow it's mysterious, and they discover it, and it can be almost anything now.
What they've done is they've reversed ontology, and they've also reversed epistemology in a way. I remember 20 years ago, there was a Secretary of State in Britain, and she said, something to do with abortion, and she said, we are going to commission research to show that abortion should be done at, boom, 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 whatever. And I thought, you're going to commission research to show the answer you've already got? No, that's not how research works. You start with a blank slate, right? And you go, now let's research it. Oh, my goodness, that's the truth. Well, okay, let's publish that. You don't go, here's my answer. And CRT just starts with an ex cathedra pronouncement. It's not possible to be subjected to racism if you're white. Where's your lab tests on this? Give me the stuff. I'll read it. I'll gladly read it, but I don't think you have anything behind you.
Yeah, it's basically an occult property. It's juju, It's
magic words.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And we have this fake moral injunction in place that you simply can't say no to black people.
Yep.
If you want to destroy a civilization, let me tell you, just create a fake moral absolute that you can't say no to black people, and they'll do the work. They'll tear it down.
As the late great Roger Scruton said, if it's ours, ruin it, destroy it. If it's white, destroy it.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. That's
why the hell do they think we're here in the first place? I think we were I think we were mucking around for 2,000-3,000 years. No. We were building a civilization. Now you're in it, and you have the freedom to go, I'm Alexandria or Ocasio-Cortez or whatever, whoever I am, and I can just say these things, and they're taken as, okay, yeah, she said it. It's cool, man. She's like a pop star. Wow, whatever she says, she's like Beyonce, It's got to be right.
Yeah.
It worries me a lot. When kids see that nonsense, they go like, yeah, it's got to be right. She said it. She's cool.
So we got a question at Countercurrents a while back from somebody going under the name Dark Plato. And Dark Plato wanted my opinion of the best Nietzsche books to read. He also wondered what my least favorite Nietzsche books were. So why not? Why not charge in? I know Mark's chomping at the bit.
I have strong opinions on this, I must say.
Yeah, I have strong opinions too. I'll just tell you mine because I already put them out there, and then we can go into you guys. My least favorite Nietzsche book is Zarathustra.
Yes, I found that absolutely the worst of his writings, I think.
It was a terrible slog. My favorite books by him, and there are several of them, it's really hard to say which is my absolute favorite. I love the second Untimely Meditation on the advantage and disadvantage.
I love the early stuff.
Yeah. I like The Birth of Tragedy quite a lot. In terms of his mature writings, Beyond Good and Evil is his most systematic, if you want to call that, work. Yeah. And it says everything in Zarathustra, but in prose, which is good enough for me. Mm-hmm. And I also very much like Twilight of the Idols. I think that's a beautiful late book with short essays and collections of aphorisms.
Yes.
And it really sums up a lot of his ideas extremely well. So, Mark, what do you recommend by Nietzsche?
I do like The Antichrist.
Like that one too, yeah.
The Antichrist. I knew a German guy down here, and he said, Der Antichrist. It doesn't mean the Antichrist. It kind of means the Antichristian as well. It's like there's double meaning in there, so that was interesting. I honestly think if someone was going to, because everyone's heard of Nietzsche, it's one of those, okay, I'm going to do philosophy, who are the cool guys? Oh, Nietzsche, yeah, he's really dangerous, let's read him. Don't read Zarathustra, it's a bombastic book. I don't like it. I would just read Ecce Homo. I think it's so nice, and obviously he was on the edge of insanity when he wrote it, but okay, don't hold that against him. I really do believe, because it revisits all of his work and just talks you through it in a kind of you know, welcome to my world kind of way. I love Ecce Homo and the Antichrist. I think those two, they're short works. And so, yeah, that's what I would say.
Yeah. Another least favorite work of mine is his late jottings on Wagner. I really don't like that. He had a very jaundiced view of Wagner.
Well, they had such an argument. They had such, you know, Wagner broke Nietzsche's heart. He really did. He didn't turn up for a Christmas party or something. What was that? What was Wagner's house called? It was called something grand, and you know, the Imperial Palace or some crazy thing. And anyway, but you remember when he was in the when he was in the Jena, Vienna, I don't know how you pronounce it, in the clinic when he after he went mad in Turin, he signed most of his postcards to Cosima.
Yeah,
I think he always loved, and love is a strange thing, and he obviously was mad, whether it was syphilis or whether it was, we don't know. I mean, there's a million different, well, not a million, but there's lots of different versions of how Nietzsche went mad. Did he catch syphilis from the prostitute? Did he have the same thing as his father had? Because his father died at the age of about 35, and then of what they then called softening of the brain.
So how about you, Stephen? Do you have some recommendations for good and bad Nietzsche?
I'm going to have to pass on that, Greg. I read Nietzsche many years ago, and not intensely. So I'm gonna go with you and Mark on that.
You're going to plead the fifth on
that. I did actually about 4 years ago. I ended up I was in Jena in Germany, and about 30 miles from Jena is Nietzsche's birthplace, and I'm trying to come up with the name of the city now. I'm trying to look it up. I can't find it. But basically I visited his house. And they turned into a museum. I sat in the chair, actually the chair where they taken that famous pose for near the end of his life, where he's sitting on his porch. And so not having read him in many years, I was able to absorb some kind of vapors from his ghost or whatever that was.
He's kind of got a white sheet over him. Yeah, that one.
Right. Yeah.
He actually went back to his mother's house to die in the, right, in the this, town, you yes. mentioned, which I can't remember either. He didn't yeah, actually
it's,
die.
It's
in
near Leipzig. It's Rücken.
Well, he was.
Oh, okay.
He actually was for a period of time, he was in an institution in Jena.
Yes, he was. Yes, I've actually got not the originals, obviously, but I've actually got the clinical notes from that whole period back at my mum's in England.
Right. His mother took care of him for a period of time back in his hometown. And then he actually died in Weimar, in an institution in Weimar.
Oh, okay.
So all three of those towns are very close together.
Do we all know what happened to his bizarre sister? I'm amazed they haven't made a movie out of this. She married a guy called Förster, like Foster, but with an umlaut over the O. And they moved to, I think, Paraguay in South America and started a German-speaking community there who were fascists. I mean, Förster was a complete and utter anti-Semitic guy. And I don't know if I've made this up. I don't think I've made this up. I think it was going until a while ago, and they all inbred. Oh God! Listen, Greg, I may have gone off the rails here, but I think Elizabeth
it's called Nueva Germania.
Right.
Yeah.
But I saw a documentary 20 years ago. It's still going, but it was like watching Deliverance. You know, there's people with the little slitty eyes playing the banjo and all that sort of stuff. Very, very strange. He despised his sister, and she loved him. Very strange.
Yes. So we have some more questions here at Entropy. Mm. Let's look at those. Okay. Jasper writes in, he sends $50, very generous. Thank you. Wow. By the way, folks, we have a matching grant. So any donations that are made during the stream will be matched one time. They'll be doubled up to $3,000. We have a $3,000 matching grant from one of our friends. So your money will go twice as far. So Jasper writes in with $50, I hold no illusions about the legitimacy of democracy in America since the fraudulent 2020 election, but I can't help wonder who would be the best candidate in 2024 from a meta-political perspective. Who do you think could shift the Overton window most effectively in our direction? DeSantis, Hawley, Cotton, Trump again, Tucker, or some dark horse? This is a great question.
Sorry, Greg. You said DeSantis?
Yeah, Ron DeSantis, the governor of
Florida. I know him. And then you mentioned a couple of others, and one of them I didn't get.
Josh Hawley from Missouri.
Cotton.
Okay.
Who's Hawley?
He's a senator from Missouri. He's actually I think he's a rather good politician.
I'll look him up. Don't worry about it now, but I'll look him up. I didn't recognize the name. So.
Yeah. I'll take a stab at this first. From a metapolitical point of view, I don't think Trump would add anything new if he ran again. I just think, you know, him running again is like that, you know, getting married for a second time. It's the triumph of hope over experience. I think it would be a mistake. And from a metapolitical point of view, I don't think it would add anything. He wouldn't break any new ground. He would just break ground in cucking and retreating, which is what he'd spent the last 2 years doing anyway. So I would find that to be, you know, not metapolitically edifying. The two people that I think would be most edifying would be Josh Hawley or Tucker Carlson. Now, both of them are fearsomely intelligent guys. They're very intelligent guys. They're much more principled and rational in their populist convictions than Trump. So they could really defend populist ideas much better than Trump. Trump would, you know, open his mouth and say something, and liberals would get the vapors, and conservatives would cuck, and then he would go on to something else. But he was never very articulate in actually defending these views. He would just blurt stuff out, and people would scream, "Oh, you can't say that! You can't say that!" Somebody like Tucker Carlson can actually defend these ideas, and so can Hawley. Hawley's a very articulate guy. And if you're just looking at a ticket from a metapolitical perspective and not thinking about who can win, right? Let's just look at it from the metapolitical perspective. I think the most interesting arguments, the most edifying educational campaign would be Tucker Carlson and Josh Hawley. Trump, I think, would have the best chance of winning. But then we wouldn't get anything politically out of that either, frankly. And we wouldn't get anything new metapolitically. We would just watch him shrink. He was the incredible shrinking president. His greatest day was the first day he went on the campaign trail when he announced his candidacy. And he kind of slowly started losing stature. Until from that point on, frankly. So, yeah, those are my thoughts. Stephen, you're one of my fellow Americans. What are your thoughts? Who would be the most metapolitically interesting guy to run on the Republican ticket in 2024?
Well, I'm very, very pessimistic about both parties. Jim Goad had a great comment. He said the two parties the politics was the two arms, Democrats and Republicans, two arms of the same monster. And I think that was in one of Jim's pieces. But I agree with you on Trump. I think Trump was
frankly, huge disappointment. I think we knew he was going to be. He was never, never coherent. Not a coherent thinker, not much of a thinker at all, and was unable, had a short attention span. He had terrible, terrible choice of people that he appointed to try and support his agenda. He put in basically people who stabbed him in the back. So Trump is completely out of the question, I think. I can't imagine that he would be able to get back to get enough support to get the nomination. And so who does that leave? I guess I would agree maybe Tucker Carlson, but the problem I see is the metapolitical problem, that is the Overton window. I just don't think it doesn't matter what Republican gets the nomination. The Overton window is narrow, and I just don't think any of those individuals have the courage and would have the support to open that window. And if that's the case, then we can't really have a political conversation that would lead us to a real election, because both parties are going to be basically committed to the same ideology in different proportions. But the Democrats are going to be gung-ho, and the Republicans will be playing catch up. I think it's a very pessimistic outlook. I think the better approach is to look for a third party candidate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Mark, do you have some thoughts here?
Yeah, I mean, it the strangest thing as a Brit looking at the States is that you don't have a third party. I mean, even if someone runs as an independent, they get like 0.01% of the votes, and they're just some wacko loony, right? At least the Brits have the Social Democrat Party, which are not, and the Brexit Party and Farage and all that, and sometimes they split the vote, but you don't seem to have a third party going there. And I agree with you about Trump. I was so happy when Trump was elected, because anyone but Clinton, that's what I thought. I think she is one of the most wicked witch of the West that people I've ever seen. Just a terrible human being, and you know, her husband is nothing to write home about. The thing with Trump is he did speak to ex Bruce Springsteen fans and you know, kind of guys who were like blue collar, and go like, hey man, yeah, you're actually batting for us. Wow. Okay, you want to build a wall so we don't have Mexicans in our country. That's good. We lay there, you know, Mexifornia and all that sort of stuff. I think he's going to run again just because he gave a speech yesterday or the day before. Yeah, no, 9/11 yesterday. He went to the New York Fire Department or the Police Department or something, and he said, I can't talk about whether I'm going to run because I can't, because of something. I can't remember what. Some clampdown and you know, boom, 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 boom. He said, but I think you're going to be very happy. So I think he will run again. The trouble is, the Republican Party didn't even want him to win. They hated it. They despised him more than the Democrats did. The Democrats almost went, yeah, get him in because the economy is going to collapse. And so we can bank it. See, whoever's in, this happens in Britain all the time. People have short-term memories. If you come in at a certain time when everything's going well, boom, 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 they'll always remember, oh, Margaret Thatcher or you know, boom, 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 whoever it might be. And then 5 years later, when everything's going really badly, they blame the guy in charge. Economies don't work like that. Economies work over 20, 30-year cycles. You know this. I know I'm not an economist, but you know what I'm talking about. You start pumping trillions of dollars. How much money has the States pumped in the last, since Biden took over? Seven, eight, nine?
Yeah, no, I mean, we're turning into Weimar, right? At some point. The currency is going
Weimar, to Weimar, Venezuela, yeah, right. Zimbabwe.
Yeah,
Stephen, I hate to interrupt you, and I'll keep this real short. People say in the British press, Venezuela, oh, it's just communism wasn't tried right. We didn't just get it right, you know, but try it again, it'll be okay. I've met people in Costa Rica here who've run from Venezuela who've told me things like, they are breaking into the zoos there to steal horses and zebras and lead them home and cut them up with chainsaws and eat them. This is not the media. These people telling me, you know, on the street, this is why I'm here, my friend. You know, my mother has no electricity for a week. Oh, that's socialism. Brilliant. Sounds great. Let's put it everywhere, shall we?
Yeah.
This shit is real.
Yeah, I think the problem with focusing on the 2024 election is that the election, elections are a distraction. They don't give us anything really different. We just get a different screw job.
Like the hippies used to say in the 60s, whoever you vote for, the government always gets in.
Right. And the Democrats now, of course, have used the COVID crisis. Now, they basically stole the last election. What I'm afraid of is in 2024, COVID, I think, is going to be an ongoing relaxation and regripping of the lockdowns. And it's going to be timed for elections. So we'll get more mail.
They'll sink it in, won't they, with a variant or a, you know, whatever it might be. Yeah.
Right. So I think there's more hope in the other direction. The Democrats, I think that the one possible, maybe slight hope is that the Democrats will become so divided between the ultra crazy left wing BLM types and the more corporate Democrats, and that they'll turn into kind of a circular firing squad to be able to put something together. So I think we need to look at the Democrats and hope.
Greg knows a bit about this, I think, because Greg, are you there? Yeah. Hi. You were kind enough. I'm trying to gin up this piece for the British mainstream media, which I know they will never write. But I asked you some time ago what your experiences were with, you know, big tech and being hassled by ADL and Southern Poverty Law Center and all these guys and all that sort of thing. And what you sent back to me made my hair curl. I couldn't believe it. They tried to poison your dog. And they, you know, this is how far these people will go now to keep the right away from the area, the agora, as it would have been in Plato's time, you know, the city square where you can, Socrates can go out in his bathrobe and go like, oh, what is justice? What is truth? We don't have an agora anymore. We can't, you know, we've got to sneak away in the shadows and speak, you know, like beer kellers, like Samizdat, you know, like Dostoevsky's wonderful novel, The Possessed or The Devils, where they have to sneak away and speak about it and Stalin and all that stuff. You know, we're in big trouble now. We can't speak. They can speak. And they will do through bullhorns all the time. This is what you must believe, my friends. This is what you must believe. Now, whoa, you know, they'll dox you. They'll boom, boom, boom. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah. Well, we have a few more questions and comments here. Let me go over to DLive. Folks, if you'd like to send DLive tokens, I'll even make sure those are matched as well. So send your diamonds, lemons, ninjaginis, matchsticks, whatever, and we would be most grateful. You can also append a question or comment to Slog has sent in 12 lemons, Johnny 5K, 2 lemons, Varyag, 2 ice cream, 1001 cuts has donated a ninjagini, thank you, and 1001 cuts has also donated 1 diamond. So over on Entropy, Elizabeth has written in with $3 US and another 3 and another 3 and another 3. Thank you very much. You're very generous. Bartleby sent $13 US and asked, is the 3K matching fund still in place? Yes, it is. So your 13 is now 26. So I think, an alt media has sent $8 US and has written in saying, hearing you talk about entropy all the time is sort of blackpilling in the sense that this is the only option you have. What happens when it gets taken down? We need more alternatives. Yeah, we do. We definitely need more alternatives. Alternatives will pop up when we need them. But really, the best way to deal with this is not alt tech. It's, well, the best way of dealing with the best way of dealing with this is legislation. And fat chance that we'll get any legislation to deal with this now. Trump had a Republican Congress for 2 years. He could have dealt with this kind of stuff then if he were a serious person, but he was not a serious person. All Mark Zuckerberg had to do was blow smoke and flatter the guy. He had an infinite appetite for that. And big tech got a free pass to basically censor people.
Absolutely.
And it was utterly foolish on his part. It was just there were smart people around him, smart people who knew him, who tried to put the gravity of the situation in front of him and get him to act. He didn't do it. Now, somebody like Hawley knows all the arguments for regulating big tech to establish freedom of speech. He is not one of these free market ideologues. He's an admirer of the progressive movement. He's an admirer of Teddy Roosevelt. He's an admirer of state power. He wants to use state power to ensure freedom of speech, prevent corporate erosion of freedom of speech. The Republican Party consists of people who make a cult of throwing away state power. They, oh no, we want the government to be less effective. Whereas the left wants more power. And if you've got a contest between people who worship power and people who worship impotence, you know who's going to win. When they're fighting for control of the government, you know who's going to win and you know who's going to put their agenda across. We need a new right that doesn't make a fetish out of impotence, that doesn't revolve around hand-wringing about rights, hand-wringing about just war theory. I saw this talk recently, and it was full of these conservative nerds who were talking about the crisis of civilization, and the best they could come up with was balancing the budget. I'm sorry, we're not going to balance our budget and solve these. The problems that we face as a civilization are not going to be solved by balanced budgets. They talked about Christian just war theory. I'm sorry, the problems that we have are not going to be solved by tying the hands of the state. And just on and on. It basically boiled down to they were whining that the left was winning and were angry that they were asking them to stop winning over and over again, and they wouldn't stop winning because we asked them politely to throw away their winning hands. These people are just impotent on a deep spiritual level. They're just eunuchs. And until we get over this fetish of classical liberalism, of small government, and so forth, we're never going to solve these problems. We need a big government that actually works for the interests of the people. That's what populists have stood for a long time. And that means that just as in the past, progressives got laws in place that the power company couldn't cut you off to freeze you in the dark if you supported politics that they didn't like, and the phone company can't cut you off in mid-conversation if you say something they don't like, we should have the same rights with banks and tech platforms. They can't censor you because they don't like the things you say. And that requires regulation, not free markets. So anyway, I think it is depressing. We had an option. We had a window of opportunity. If we had freedom of speech, we can do all the rest. Just give the scruffy bunch of resistance people and dissidents on the internet freedom of speech, and we'll do all the work. But they didn't do that. They had 2 years, and they frittered away the time. And it's profoundly depressing. That is a window of opportunity that may never open again.
You're right, Greg. I mean, that's the thing. More than anything else, when Trump came in, the Republicans had the White House. They had both houses of Congress. They had the Supreme Court, and absolutely, they just absolutely collapsed. And look, and look where we're at now with this assault on Western civilization, and it's being sanctioned at the highest levels.
Yeah, it's either being encouraged or it's just these people are simply too weak to stop it.
Yeah. So I think there's some encouragement. And I forget which of the Countercurrents writers had a piece, but basically saying that there's actually the failure in Afghanistan in some respects is a good unintended consequence for the right, for the alt-right, because it shows the total impotence and incompetence of the ruling class and of the empire.
I agree with that. I think that the empire's time might be shorter than we thought, that the sheer level of incompetence and impotence here might indicate that they're much hollower and much weaker than we feared. Most people, especially people on the right, in their heart of hearts, think that if there are serious people anywhere in the U.S. government, there would surely be some in the military, right? They tend to be more patriotic. They think in terms of things like killing and dying. They're not thinking in terms of all this goofy happy talk, liberal happy talk. There's nothing more realist than death in terms of political realism. And yet we found that they left Afghanistan and they had no contingency plans in place to prevent $85 billion worth of weapons getting into the hands of the Taliban, who were our enemies. I guarantee you, in any functioning military, there are offices full of people who are making contingency plans and war games and things like that. You go to a little country in Europe, Slovenia. Go to Slovenia. Slovenia probably has a military. I know they have a military. And their military probably has people doing contingency plans. And they have contingency plans about how they would invade Denmark. They just come up with this stuff. You know, it's make work stuff, right? They have contingency plans for stuff. The United States has contingency plans for how we would invade Denmark by way of Sweden or by way of Finland. That's what they do. And yet... nobody had any contingency plans in place to prevent weapons from falling into the hands of the Taliban, $85 billion worth, or the biometric data on all of our collaborators in the country. That is just a level of incompetence that beggars belief. And if they're that hollow in the military, that could bode very, very ill for the regime's survival. And it creates a much more dangerous, unstable world. As soon as this Afghanistan thing happened, the Chinese started making really ominous noises about Taiwan. They said, you know, you Taiwanese, do you think these people are going to come to your rescue? It really it's going to encourage a lot of wars and adventurism around the world, because the United States was, for better or worse, keeping a lid on a lot of this stuff. But if we can't plausibly do that anymore, there's going to be a lot of change. And a lot of it isn't going to be for the better, certainly in the short run. So,
well, I think domestically in the short run, I think what this does is it further increases the loss of confidence broadly. The loss of confidence in the political establishment. What that means is that the political situation is going to become increasingly unstable. Maybe in the long term, that's a good thing, because when power comes up for grabs, when there's more competition, then maybe there's an opportunity for the populist right to make progress and to take back maybe some of the things that we've lost. So. Short term, I think it's going to be really ugly. Long term, maybe there's some possibilities.
Yeah, I would agree. I have a question here from Eric, and this will be our last question. He asks, what's the difference between physical and moral courage, and can we give examples of the two? That's an interesting question. My thought is that physical courage is basically courage in the face of, well, physical danger, physical threat. Think of soldiers in battle, that kind of courage. Whereas moral courage has more to do with standing up to more subtle pressures, being shamed, being yelled at, being disapproved of by your mother, things like that. So one has to do with actually dealing with fear of physical death and injury, and the other is more subtle, I think. Mark, do you have any thoughts on the distinction between physical and moral courage?
Well, I was reading earlier on today, because obviously everything's been 9/11, you know, for the last couple of days, and where were you and what happened and so on. And I was reading about firefighters who ran into the second building and all the way up the stairs, knowing that probably something really, really bad was going to happen, and it did, and they died. There's no question about that. That's a simple straight line. That's moral courage. You ran into that building, you ran all the way upstairs to save people, and you knew that, and then bang, second plane hits, they're dead. That is something that I could never even think about achieving myself. Morality is very strange. As I said to you earlier on, Greg, morality is a constructed thing. If you cheat on your wife, do you tell her to keep your marriage good, or do you keep it a secret and keep your marriage good? It's a very, very, you know, morality comes on many, 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 many levels. I'm sure you saw all the many, many, not conspiracy theories, but just theories, you know. 9/11 guys, they were trained only to take off planes, but they never learned how to land, and boom, boom, boom. Yeah, and they said afterwards, yeah, we kind of knew these guys were under investigation, you know. Yeah, really? Well, why didn't you do something about it then? Why didn't you do anything at the time? After Pearl Harbor, I think I'm right in saying, they interned all the Japanese, didn't they?
Yes.
They interned them on the West Coast, yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah, I didn't know that. I thought they just... bang, everyone Japanese goes to jail for the moment.
They not only interned the West Coast Japanese, but they also confiscated their property. Many of these were right. Second and third generation loyal Japanese Americans. That property was confiscated by FDR's assistant secretary of the treasury, and he basically distributed it to his friends. So not only were they thrown concentration camp, but
you've just made me now tomorrow is going to be me checking that up, and I'm sure you're right. But wow, that's incredible. That's incredible. After 9/11, the sensible view would have been a moratorium on all Muslim immigration for a couple of years. Check everyone. Don't put them in jail. Just make them come along to, you know, your local police station, and you are okay, sign this, let's give us all your details and we'll check you out, and if you're no good, in jail you go, and if you are okay, yeah, you're right, you're free to go. And in fact, what you had was people trying to build a mosque on the Twin Towers site. How self-hating do you have to be to build a mosque on the site of possibly the biggest atrocity in my lifetime, certainly, but I'm sure in all of our lifetimes. How buckled do you have to be in your morality to go like, yeah, let's help them?
Yeah, so Stephen, do you have a distinction between physical and moral courage?
Yeah. Yeah, I had a good friend in college. This is a great example of physical courage. He was working on the ships in the Great Lakes, and one of his co-workers went overboard in the icy waters of Lake Superior. And my friend, who could not swim, tied a rope around his waist, jumped into the jumped into the waters and rescued his coworker. So that kind of physical courage, it was truly remarkable and admirable. And then as far as moral courage, it's the courage to stand up and for a principle that you believe in and yes. face consequences, yes. to be fired, terminated from a position, for exercise. And maybe one of the greatest examples of all time, and it's actually a combination of both moral and physical courage, was, of course, Sir Thomas More and refusing Henry VIII.
He gave
up his life for his moral principles. I mean,
murder in the cathedral.
Right, right.
Well, that's Beckett.
That's Beckett. Sorry, yeah. wrong person. Sorry about that. Don't let me swing you off your point.
Right. Yeah. So those would be the examples I would give.
Yeah. You think of Galileo under the pressure of the church.
Right. Right.
That had moral and physical elements to it, definitely.
When Giordano Bruno went back to Rome, and he knew he was going to die. He knew he was, but he went back for his family. Jesus did it. Jesus didn't have to go to Gethsemane. You know, there was a way out. Socrates was given a way out in the Phaedo, in the lovely death, not lovely, it's just horrible, really. It makes me cry every time. But the Phaedo, the death cell scene before the hemlock, they say to, who's it, Crates? And I don't think Plato might have been there. I can't remember. There are a couple of other guys. And anyway, he says, like, you know, you can go. There was some celebration day for Delphi. There was a storm and the kids were all saved. They said to Socrates, yeah, you can get out. They've given you an out, all right? You can just sneak off with us. And he said, no, the law of the country is the law of the country. If they've delivered me to death, I will take my death because I am a philosopher and philosophy is preparation for death. That's what he says. I don't know what the ancient Greek is, but it's morality is a it's very strange. Morals are, I mean, think of serial killers, for example. I won't hold you too long on this one, but serial killers actually behave in a morally consistent way. They think what they're doing is fine. If you know the two great books, No Country for Old Men by Cormac McCarthy, which was made into a great movie, and Hannibal by Thomas Harris, the two dreadful evil killers in that, Anton Chigurh and Hannibal Lecter, they run to a very straight moral code. They kill people who are in their way, but they are consistent. And once that psychopathy becomes the ruling class, then we're in big trouble. Then we're in big trouble. Look at the Clintons. I mean, all those deaths and apparent suicides and so on and so forth. I mean, it's scary stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, guys, we've been going at this for 2 hours, and I would like to wrap up here. But I think we should do this again. I think it's good to. I want to mix up the panels a bit more, and I want to bring out some of our writers, more of our writers, and get to know you all better. Mm-hmm. And I think this has been a good exercise in that. So I want to thank you both for coming on. I want to thank all the listeners out there, especially the donors. I want to thank our moderators for keeping it all very civilized. Mark, what's coming up from you? What can people expect in the near future at Countercurrents?
Well, you know this perfectly well. I'm writing for you regularly now. I had a very bad time with another website, which I won't mention, but I've told you who they are, and they were really. It's a pleasure to write for Countercurrents. You're not censored at all. You can write what you write, and so on and so forth. I am working on a book, and Steve and I'd like to see what you think about this. The basic premise of the book is philosophy is pretty much dying now. It's withering on the vine. Woke culture is now. It started in the Industrial Revolution when science split from philosophy and philosophy just got left with, like, what have we got left? Morals, language and metaphysics. Oh, great. Yeah, fuck off. You can't build a bridge. You can't invent a vaccine. So philosophy kind of went west. Now I don't know where philosophy is. And of course, I'll tell you this very quickly. You probably know it anyway. There was a building in Edinburgh in Scotland called the David Hume Building. But they found something that Hume wrote, which was a bit racist. So they've now renamed the building. I can't remember even know what they call it, probably Nelson Mandela Building or something. But anyway, that's what's happening now. Philosophy is being erased, ironed out of. And I think it's not such a bad thing, because the last time it happened in the Middle Ages, it came back in the Renaissance alive and kicking. You know, it really came back and yes. Got all the great stuff after that. So I'd love to hear what you think about that.
Well, I think that's certainly sounds like a great premise to start with. And I guess I sort of agree with you. I think, I think philosophy I think the universities are dying. They've turned into propaganda.
Yes.
And philosophy. And so if we're talking about academic philosophy, I think it's going to go away at some point, or
it's withering on the vine. It's
right. And what that means then is that independent philosophers, it opens up opportunities. And I think with the technology and the change in society, there's an opportunity for a rebirth.
I can't remember where I read it, but apparently Kant and Greg probably knows where this comes from. Apparently Kant wrote something like, the Negroes are a clearly inferior race to white people, and they are only fit to be slaves. And bang, I don't even know where that comes from, but I read it and I've never checked it out. But, bum, bum, bum. But for that, all of Kant has to go. The critique of pure reason, the critique of practical reason, the one that I think Greg wrote his book on, the first one about Swedenborg. That, you know what I mean? You say one thing and everything has to go. All of your writing has to go. You know, because Heidegger was a Nazi, we can't read Being and Time anymore, because it's kind of Nazi literature. You know, what are you thinking about? What do you mean? Make any sense to me?
Well, Stephen, you have something coming up very soon at Countercurrents. Do you want to tease that a little bit?
The blog piece that I've just submitted, is that what you're referring to?
Yeah.
I reworked a piece I wrote a while back, brought it up to date, but the title is Why the Left Hates Guns. I think it will be appreciated. The left, of course, the left hates guns because guns symbolize not only because what they actually do, they're very powerful and they're equalizers. They mm-hmm. equalize the disparities of powers, and they're very symbolic. They reinforce power, which is why soldiers carry them and why policemen carry them. And so the left is being very jealous of power, because only they deserve power. So they're very jealous of power. So they want to make sure that's why they want to take the guns away. And I hope come out pretty soon, and you can see what you think about it.
Well, great. Well,
Stephen, I just want to tell you a very short 30-second story. In Costa Rica, there is no army. There hasn't been since the 1948 Civil War, which was very bloody and horrible, and so they didn't have a standing army. Their back is covered by the United States government, because all the cocaine comes through here, so they have to regulate. But all the cops here are very, very fit, because there's no army to join. You know what I mean? And they all carry guns. They all carry guns. I got talking with a cop the other day in a bar, and I said, "What happens if someone breaks into my apartment here? Can I hit them or something?" He says, "No, you shoot them." And I said, "I haven't got a gun." He said, "Well, then, have you got a machete?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, you kill them with that." I said, "What if I kill them outside my apartment?" And he said, "You drag them into your apartment,
right.
You clean the blood, and then you call the cops and go, guy came into my..." Then you kick your own door in.
Right.
It's very kind of like easy come, easy go here. You know.
Right.
Well, folks, I really enjoyed this, and we have to wrap up, but let's definitely do this again soon. And I look forward to all of your forthcoming writing at Countercurrents. We have another piece by Mark Gullick coming out this week on the philosophy profession. So, folks, we will be back next Sunday with another episode of Countercurrents Radio. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks so much, thanks, Greg. Thank you. Nice to meet you, Stephen.
Nice to meet you.
All right. Bye.